Like Flip East title. Oh Lord, don't let them drop that atomic bomb on me.
Welcome and thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Lawrence Lessig, who joins Bob Chesney to talk about institutional corruption. Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law at Harvard Law School. His current work concerns institutional corruption and the economy of influence that weakens the effectiveness of an institution or weakens the public trust in it.
Larry Lessig, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Lessig is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, author of the new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Larry, you discuss this a bit in the book, and I think it's a point that I'm greatly interested in and want to see more work on down the road, and we'll hopefully do programs on this, which is our judicial system is also being greatly transformed right now. And in research I'm doing for another book with John Nichols right now, we've been looking at how the judicial system in America was perceived. And it's becoming clearer to me that the notion that I grew up with, and I suspect you did, that you know the court system basically was fair and just and worked, has not always been that case. That in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the judicial system was considered extraordinarily corrupt and on the take. And it really was cleaned up significantly in the middle parts of the 20th century. And now it seems like we're heading back into a zone where the trust in our judicial system is shrinking dramatically, not just with appointed judges who are politicized, as with the Supreme Court, but in these state elections where there's just an enormous amount of money going and flooding these elections, almost all coming from commercial interest. And where does that fit into your argument?
Yeah, so first, I haven't grown up yet, so I don't know what you're talking about what I knew growing up.
Okay.
Second, yeah, and I think that I look forward to this book because getting a historical perspective on the trust or confidence we have in institutions is extremely important because we kind of take what we have today and assume it's always been thus. I think right now we have very high trust in the kind of the federal judicial branch from the standpoint of corruption, like money corruption. A lot of us are skeptical about the political corruption of the judicial branch, at least at the highest level. And there's lots of work that tries to suggest that even at the appellate level, there's too much sensitivity to political views rather than what we would think of as legal views. But I don't think anybody credible really believes that money is driving, the money that might directly or indirectly benefit justices is driving what the Supreme Court does. But at the state level, that's completely different. States adopted a really stupid progressive idea from, Jackson's the first to suggest it, but really takes over in the beginning of the last century, to make these judges elected. The reason for that was it was thought to be a solution to the problem of corruption, because, if you could elect them rather than have them appointed by party bosses, it would be harder for the party bosses to use the appointment as part of their corrupt scheme. So I understand the motivation for it. But what it did was, or has done recently, is just make them instead answerable to a different kind of party boss. Now it's the corporate party boss that is very keen to spend enormous amounts of money to direct the elections in ways that guarantee a state court that's favorable to the people who are funding the interest. So, the Supreme Court addressed this in the scheme of things in a small case, in a West Virginia case, this case Massey versus Caperton Cole, this is actually parallels a plot in a John Grisham novel, The Appeal, mm-hmm. where Massey Cole loses at the trial court level some $50 million judgment against it for all sorts of bad behavior with respect to the way in which it was managing its coal mines. And then as it's being appealed, the president of Massey Cole spends $3 million in independent expenditures to support a particular candidate for the highest appellate court that's going to hear the case. And that candidate wins, and that candidate then eventually casts a vote, which is the deciding vote that basically reverses the judgment against the coal company, and it goes back down. And the question for the Supreme Court was, does that create the appearance of impropriety, even if you wouldn't say directly that you had any evidence that there was any bribery or any direct influence, and this was an independent expenditure, so it shouldn't have been coordinated, but does it still just give too much of a flavor of influence that it reeks for the political system? And the Supreme Court said yes, and they created a constitutional right to challenge such cases where the judge refuses to step aside because of just the flavor of, mm-hmm. of corruption or bribery, not bribery, but corruption or improper influence. That's a small example of a practice which is much more systematic and pronounced, especially in states like Illinois, where an enormous amount of money is spent, especially in the context of insurance companies, to get the right kind of justices. And then those right kind of justices do the most extraordinary things to benefit the people who have funded their campaigns. And it's extremely hard to, or I just think it's unfair to expect of the public anything other than the cynicism which the public increasingly has towards these judges. And you know, I think the solution to this, you know, in this context, I don't think we should be publicly funding. I think we should go back to an appointment system we can have some confidence in. Because, you know, it doesn't seem to me that we need to be electing judges in any of these contexts. We can be appointing judges that have the right kind of credentials, and we can think of all sorts of creative ways to make sure they're not too politically.
You know, frankly, I'm at the point, as I look at some of these decisions like you've been talking about, as I study, where I think we'd almost be better feel like a jury selection of registered lawyers and just grab them out of a hat.
Absolutely.
We'd get it more likely to get fair treatment.
Yeah.
Lira, we've only got a few minutes left, and one issue that I'd like you to talk about, because, you know, it's the heart and soul of your solution, which is constitutional reform. And it's an issue that is done rarely, especially the Constitutional Convention, done never. But it's in our Constitution. You're a constitutional lawyer. And when this has come up in the past in conversations I've had with folks or with stuff I've read, it's, you know, the idea of having a Constitutional Convention, you get the impression that the most deranged lunatics in the country will suddenly be writing extraordinary changes in the Constitution that make life miserable, that it'd be the worst possible thing that could happen. And when I read your discussion of it, it had a very different presentation of how it would take place. What does a constitutional convention mean?
Right. So the framers had in Article 5, had a plan for amending our Constitution, which was originally just to have Congress propose amendments and have the states ratify them. And then somebody said, well, what if Congress itself is the problem? And so they said, good point. What we need to do is make it so that we have a way around Congress. And so what the way around Congress is that the states get to call on Congress or petition Congress to call a convention. And that convention only has the power to propose amendments. And so the convention meets, it decides which amendments to propose, then those amendments get sent out to the states by Congress to be ratified. And if 3/4 of the states, 38 states, ratify those amendments, they become part of the Constitution. So true, the convention could propose crazy amendments. But 38 is a huge number in constitutional politics. 13 states could block any proposed amendment. And there are plainly 13 red states and 13 blue states out there. So neither side needs to fear that the other side's going to somehow take over and do something extremely crazy. You might not have a lot of faith in state legislatures. I actually do, but you might not. But you've got to at least have faith in 25% of state legislatures to block really crazy reform. But I think that there's even more upside to the convention process than that makes it sound. Because in my view, you know, going back to your randomly selected lawyers, I actually think that there's good reason to believe that randomly selected citizens as part of the convention would come up with much more sensible, much more public-spirited, much more public-interested proposals for changing the Constitution than any 500 politicians would ever do. Because the thing that this is the one sport where the amateur sport is actually better than the professional, because the professional is, you know, a professional politician is very good at knowing exactly what to do to keep his or her interests happy, special interests happy. Whereas the amateur, if you can summon them to focus on this in the right way, with the right information and in the right context, can actually think about the public interest in a way that I think most people would find quite important and inspiring. So I realize that sounds like a really crazy idea, maybe the craziest idea in this book, and that's why I say that we should be right now launching a series of mock constitutional conventions, where we randomly select 300 or 500 people from a state or from a region, and run what Jim Fishkin calls a deliberative poll around constitutional issues. And then let's show what 50 of these mock constitutional conventions produce as a way to demonstrate what I think would be demonstrated, that that this convention process, even just including ordinary citizens, would propose and produce reform that would be extremely inspiring and important reform that could actually help us out of this constitutional mess.
Larry Lessig, we've only got a little less than a minute or so left. I know that you mentioned Root Strikers earlier and that you formed a group that's connected to your work, Root Strikers. And if I'm not mistaken, that's also connected with United Republic. So for listeners who want to get involved, take the next step, where should they go?
So if you go to rootstrikers.org, you can join us in a project which is going to be devoted to finding every single possible creative way that we can to get ordinary citizens to recognize the route to the problems they all identify. So we have an extremely important public education process here that's not going to happen by, you know, 30-second television ads or by the president lecturing people on television. It's going to happen by people at a dinner table or at a meetup or at a bar, you know, talking about this issue in a way that begins to make ordinary Americans recognize what I think some of us have become obsessed with. So that's the easiest thing to do, is go to rootstrikers.org and sign up and join the project. The other important thing you can do is you can buy 10,000 copies of my book and give it to your 10,000 best friends, or at least 9,999, keep one for yourself.
All right, Larry Lessig, author of Republic Lost. I want to thank you for taking time from your schedule to join us today at Media Matters.
Great, thank you, Bob.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. President John F. Kennedy, speaking from the White House, announces the introduction of civil rights legislation in 1963.
The events in Birmingham and elsewhere have so increased the cries for equality that no city or state or legislative body can prudently choose to ignore them. We face, therefore, a moral crisis as a country and a people. It is a time to act in the Congress, in your state, and local legislative body, and above all of our daily lives. It is not enough to pin the blame on others, to say this is a problem of one section of the country or another, or to deplore the facts that we face. A great change is at hand, and our task, our obligation, is to make that revolution, that change, peaceful and constructive for all. Those who do nothing are inviting shame as well as violence. Those who act boldly are recognizing right as well as reality. Next week, I shall ask the Congress of the United States to act, to make a commitment it has not fully made in this century to the proposition that race has no place in American life or law.
We got to move these refrigerators. We got to move these. brain working. That's the way you do it. You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working. That's the way you do it. Money for nothing and your chicks for free. Money for nothing.
Painted up your lips and rolled and curled your tinted hair. Ruby, are you contemplating going out somewhere? The shadow on the wall tells me the sun is going down. Take your love to town. It wasn't me that started that old crazy Asian war, but I was proud to go and do my patriotic chore. And yes, it's true that I'm not the man I used to be. Some company. It's hard to love a man whose legs are bent and paralyzed. And the wants and the needs of a woman your age, Ruby, I realize. But it won't be long, I've heard them say, until I'm not around.
Now, 'cause I just heard the slamming of the door. The way I know I've heard it slam 100 times before. And if I could move, I'd get my gun and put her in the ground. Take your love to town. Oh, for God's sakes, turn around.
And now for something completely different.